Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Phil St John. Welcome, Phil.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Well, you are just about to come to an end of your appointment as the Chief Executive Officer, the CEO of the City of Fremantle, which has been a five-year, no doubt, thrilling time, Phil.
Yes, it has been thrilling, Michael. Yes, yes. It's been a very rewarding time.
Well, yeah. Congratulations on your term, 5 years as the CEO. We'll go back into your other history, which many will know, with Fremantle. But it's all coming to an end following your recent resignation. You and the Mayor are sort of leaving at the same time.
Yes, we are, yes. And some have made something of that, but the timing is actually coincidental.
You were appointed at a time, and you go back and look at it in 2016, when there was a lot happening in Fremantle. Mm. There were plans afoot, and the word revitalising was probably the one you most commonly saw. Was that what was happening? You were brought in as an agent of change or development?
No, look, I don't think so. I mean, but I think, you know, I think obviously I was a known quantity in Fremantle. I had I knew the council. I'd worked previously as director of planning for 8 years, and I think enjoyed a good reputation with the council as someone who was effective and I guess responsive to the council's needs and could make the changes to the organisation that were needed. I think the council wanted two things. I think they obviously wanted someone who would take the King Square project from essentially what it was 5 years ago, which was a legal agreement and a bunch of documents and a bunch of plans, to actually a new building, but also to reform certain aspects of the organisation. And there were some very key areas the council gave me when I started of reform of the organisation. So I guess there were two focuses. One was around implementation of King Square, and the other was around organisational reform.
Now, a lot's happened in the 5 years. King's Square has been punctuated, if not punctured, along the way by COVID, but it's getting closer and closer. Mm. Just while we're on that, when do you think the grand unveiling will happen?
I think it's likely to be August. I think it's likely to be August. We'll be in there. I mean, the building is a complex building, and even now we're just discussing questions around when we move in $1 million worth of IT server, for example, and then that, of course, we had an internal discussion around, you know, how you manage that in a building that's not quite yet finished and the risks with that. So it inevitably will take a bit longer than we think, but I think August is probably a fairly safe bet.
Local government, you have now spent quite a time there. You came in as a planner, you worked in various local governments. You mentioned your 8 years as Director of Planning in Fremantle. You had a short stint at Wanneroo before you came back as CEO. So you've seen local government from many sides. Once upon a time, it was the three R's, roads and rates and rubbish. Yes. And I guess they're still, except for roads, perhaps keen, important areas for
local
government.
They absolutely are. And look, you know, I think, in some ways, I think, I would say neglect again is the wrong word, but I think a refocus on some of those core things is actually quite important. Maintaining a focus on that is important. You know, the council has an aspiration for revitalisation of the city centre, and I think that's worked as well as it could. I do think it's time, particularly for Fremantle, but for most councils I deal with, to also not do that at the expense of those basic core services, because I think, you know, when it comes out, that is why we are, but, you know, that is one of the reasons why we're there. I think you neglect those at your peril a bit, you know, and we have certainly tried to, I mean, during my time, we've implemented the three bin system. Rubbish, of course, has got extraordinarily complicated. The question of what you do with rubbish is a very complex question, and one I suspect the community probably doesn't really understand. You know, there's probably not a very good understanding, really, of what happens to stuff when you put it in your bin.
Yes, yeah. or on the curbside for periodic cleanups, which I gather may be under review.
Well, it is, and look, we've all, because again it's complicated. You know, so that, of course, you know, creates visual blight. It creates dumping. It creates contamination, mixture of waste. Mixture of waste is huge, And, you know, I said to someone the other day, who's not been tempted on a Sunday night you're cleaning out just to bung it in the wrong bin? And, of course, the minute you do that, that's a problem down the line.
Yes.
You know, and even people who are fairly waste conscious, like can sometimes be one of those. Yeah, you know, you're running around, you're packing up your kids' stuff, you take the bin out on a Sunday night. Who hasn't been occasionally tempted just to bung it in, get rid of it? I just want to, you know, it's very difficult. So this question around rubbish separation.
You'll go on and on.
It could take all day. But it is an interesting area that the community, I think, needs to understand a bit better. I think an interesting thing that, you know, you drop your Coke bottle or something, I don't drink Coke, you drop your Coke bottle into the recycling bin, I think you've done the right thing. That's two types of plastic. It's paper, glue, and sticky, sugary water. Sugary liquid. All which have to be separated.
You're hurting my brain.
Yeah, I know. It's a scary thing. It's a scary thing. Yeah.
Come back to Fremantle very directly. I've always wondered, many of us think it's the case, whether Fremantle is distinctively different from other local governments. Mm. One can generalise and be sort of superficial about that, but you've been in a number of Perth local governments. Mm. What's the answer?
Look, I think Fremantle is distinctly different. There is, I think we have a far more engaged community in Fremantle, and ultimately I think that's a good thing. We have a higher percentage of voter turnout, I think, than our council in Western Australia. We have a very engaged community. We have a relatively large councillor group for our size compared to other councils. But they are also a council who are very, very engaged. And so, yeah, look, I think there are some unique characteristics about Fremantle Council.
What are they?
Well, I think the thing that I think we've really enjoyed and I think we've got right is the council-staff relationship. You know, if you look at where councils, perhaps other councils, perhaps have not got this right, where there have been inquiries and problems, there are some councils where there's been an over-application, I think, of the principles around a council's role and the staff's role, where the staff have been sort of keep the council out, and the council then feel disempowered and feel not trusted and not properly part of the decision-making process. A council, another council said to me, we feel you know, herded into a corner, you know, by the staff. And of course, on the other hand, you've got councillors who perhaps exceed their role and try and influence staff too much. I think at Fremantle we've got the balance pretty well. And I think that's, you know, one of the things I'm proud of, and I think the council should be proud of, that we have a very collaborative working relationship. We can talk very robustly of each other about what's going on and about make decision making, but ultimately there is respect for each other's roles, and the council respect the staff's role and the staff respect the council's role. And it's all the better for it. So we might take a bit longer to make decisions sometimes, but I think we make good decisions, and they're made in a very harmonious way. And there is an exceptional relationship with the council and staff. I think another thing that we are a bit different about, Michael, is that, and again, this is one thing I've tried to lead in the organisation, is empowerment of managers to actually undertake the work and actually provide advice directly to the council. So you might come to a council committee meeting at Fremantle and you might see 8 or 10 managers sitting there. And sometimes people kind of snigger and say, oh, how many council staff do you really need? But of course, I think it works very well. One, that the managers feel empowered and they feel part of the process. And the council get the advice from the people who are doing the work.
And
that works very well.
Yes. Mm. In taking that point a little further, what in a technical sense is the role of a council officer versus the role of the elected members?
So, I mean, it's prescribed by legislation, but I mean, so the elected member's role is to represent the community, to, you know, vote and make decisions, and, you know, to set policy and set direction for the council. There are many areas where the council is under pressure to perhaps, go beyond that role. You know, the community do sort of hold them to account for things the officers do, and I've always tried to appreciate that creates a challenge for the council. So, for example, on the current issues around industrial relations are a case in point, that the councillors, you know, in terms of the media, in terms of some of the politics, are held to account for my decisions and decisions which they they don't have a role in, and they understand they don't have a role in that. So in terms of the role of the staff, so the staff across the board primarily are there to advise the council, to carry out the decisions of the council, to carry out the requirements of the legislation that we operate under, and of course to employ and to manage the affairs of the council on a day-to-day basis, in a nutshell.
What would be the sort of highest profile areas of decision making for the city of Fremantle? I'd be right in thinking at some of the major land development proposals that still fall under their control. Fewer and fewer of the big ones, I suppose.
Yes. So, so I guess the big decisions would be around some development decisions. Absolutely. Obviously, King Square was the decision for the King Square business plan. It was a number of years ago now. Was a huge commitment, probably the biggest the council has ever made or will ever make.
Yes.
There are other decisions which perhaps are not so significant from a financial perspective, but politically quite significant. So I guess the Youth Plaza, the Esplanade Youth Plaza a number of years ago.
Yes.
That was a very major decision. Amendment 49 to the scheme was, again, when I was Director of Planning, was a huge decision of the council.
Yes.
Something it had never done before, and I could talk about that all day, but it is an interesting decision because that is the basis on which everything has happened. You know, so I'm very proud of Amendment 49.
Take Amendment 49. This is to amend the planning system that operates locally in Fremantle and affects other statewide decision-making for Fremantle. First of all, you need a council, presumably, and in that case, I think Brett Pettit is the mayor leading the charge to in a sense create more discretion for planning in Fremantle, but you need technical advice to explain how the planning system might work to achieve those outcomes. Is that a broadly correct statement? Do the members take complete charge and run with that, and staff run behind?
No, look, again, so Amendment 49 was a very collaborative process, Michael. It wasn't, it was worked up, I guess, I mean, it was based on staff recommendations, but we did a number of workshops with the staff, with the council, around how the amendment would end up and the kind of provisions that would go with it. One of the interesting things about Amendment 49, it wasn't actually around providing the council more discretion. My judgment was that we needed to actually have some more certainty and a slightly less flexible planning system in some ways, because one of the problems in Fremantle when I commenced as Director of Planning was that everything was discretionary. There was a very flexible discretionary scheme, and it meant that every single development, you know, could be anything between X height and Y height, and there was no certainty for developers, no certainty for the community, and in an environment where the council wanted to revitalise, and we also accepted that revitalisation was a long-term thing, my judgment advice to council is you actually need a more robust, somewhat inflexible planning system so we get some certainty of outcome. And something that would sort of lock in place a planning regime as opposed to simply ebb and flow with the changes of the Fremantle politics. And so that was the advice I gave council. They accepted that advice, and that's really the base of Amendment 49 now. And I think that's held because, of course, the council has changed over the years. But you need more than a council cycle. So look how long the King Square project has taken. You know, things will always take a lot longer than you think they will. You know, we've still got a number of the sites in Amendment 49, you know, the Walsall Shopping Centre site, for example, still not redeveloped. So having a robust scheme has been, I think, a good thing and will remain a good thing, because at least those landowners then have some confidence and certainty around that. The downside is that, of course, we have found it a bit inflexible, but that's also an advantage. You know, its inflexibility is an advantage as it is a disadvantage.
I mentioned that there are those decisions which fall to the council to make in relation to planning and development. And of course, there are those decisions that Fremantle has some influence on but don't directly make the decisions. You've got the JDAP system, for example, and more recently, we've got the COVID planning legislation, which is meant to be limited in time. We'll wait and see whether, like many temporary things, it becomes more permanent. What's your take on where planning as a broad proposition has got to in this regulatory sense, and what does Fremantle think about the apparent or real loss of control?
I mean, I think Fremantle, through embodying our objectives into the scheme, we at least have still got an environment where JDAPs are still bound by the local planning scheme. So my advice to the council has been, you still have a place in the planning system in terms of putting scheme provisions and policy. And if they're properly made, that binds the JDAP as it does you, and it binds the SAT. So you know, we've invested a lot in planning provisions and planning policy. I do worry a bit about the kind of centralisation of planning power. And I say, as a planner who's pro appropriate development and infill, but it does worry me a bit, because I think what it does is it sort of creates a sense of disempowerment for the council and the community, and perhaps some cynicism. I remember one councillor said to me when JDAPs came in, they said, well, they're taking away the reason why good people want to become a councillor. And I kind of I could kind of see that. It felt like it was a bit of a sledgehammer approach to bring in JDAPs. At the time, I remember asking the people who were promoting those, what is the objective? What are we trying to do here? Is this different planning decisions? Is it faster decisions? And no one's ever really clear what JDAPs were for, you know. And interestingly, you know, again, I could talk about this all day, Mark. If you look at the system, you know, I mean, the state interest, it clearly should be, in my view, that housing targets are met and employment targets are met, and met in a manner that is consistent with government policy and consistent with government infrastructure investment decisions. Beyond that, I'm not quite sure what the state's interest in local planning is or should be. I don't think it's, should a balcony be here or here? Or should it be of this, you know? And so it feels that the kind of control is kind of in the wrong places. You know, if you look at decisions like, you know, the unpopular decisions in Netherlands and Zuby and places, or in Frio, it's like, well, I would prefer a process, an approach that said to councils, look, these are the state objectives. As long as you could deliver a local planning scheme that provides for those, then really then the community can be empowered. I accept that there needs to be regional planning policy, and I accept that councils individually won't be able to deliver that. But I do think that once, if a council, in the way that Fremantle has been able to go to the state and say, this is how this community has agreed to meet your targets, then we should somehow then be allowed then. Because what we've done is we've actually disincentivized, I think, progressive councils trying to do that. You know, again, councils have said to me, for example, it gets harder now to argue for density because one of the arguments, or infill, because one of the arguments is people say, you're not even going to make that decision. So when now the council creates a planning policy, the community might say, and you guys won't even be the ones who actually implement this. So why would I even, so it's made people more cautious.
Yes. Well, one assumes in all of this that JDAPs are going to remain. Mm-hmm. And I made a comment about the COVID planning system, whether or not it'll remain in some form, because it sort of frees the ultimate decision maker under the COVID rules from having or being bound by any of the local rules. Mm-hmm. You mentioned density. This is the thing that gets people very excited. The City of Fremantle is actually a very small, geographically, local government area. There's no doubt room for more dense development. Is the attitude of Fremantle people to collectivisers different when it comes to density than people in Swanbourne or Florida Park or City Beach or anywhere else?
Look, it is a polarising question in the community, I think, isn't it? I wouldn't presume to say is the attitude, I mean, certainly the attitude of Fremantle Council, in as much as the council represents the community, and the council is progressive. The council accepts that density is necessary for a number of reasons. It also accepts that housing diversity is important. That's probably the main, that we do need to have more houses in the area just to keep a stable population. You know, I always quote a statistic that says that, you know, 30 years ago, there was probably, you know, I can get the right figures, there was probably, you know, an average of 3 people per house. Now there's probably about, you know, 2.5 to 1. So it's like, we need more housing just to keep the same population stable. Just to keep our population, we need more houses.
Keep the rate base.
Well, keep the rate base. Keep the shopping base. Keep everything.
Yes.
So we do need to work. And it is a conundrum, because I do accept, and I again have some sympathy for people who will say, well, you know, my house is my primary investment. My house is, I don't want to see any threat to that, and see infill as a threat. And I do understand that. And again, part of my desire would be to see a more holistic kind of conversation around that with the community. I don't think planning has particularly sold density infill very well or clearly. You know, so I do understand why community kind of gets its back up a bit. And again, this is part of the problem, I think. If there could be a clear understanding to say to Fremantle or any council, this is your target, everybody is sharing this thing, you know, this thing called density. If everybody shared it in a fair way, then you might then accept that the community can make decisions about how it should occur. One of the worries is you see is, and I've heard this said by many times by people in the community saying, well, Fremantle has already got its fair share, and why don't you go and talk to Council X down the road who haven't, you know? And that's a, I can kind of understand that. I can say, well, I'm only responsible for Fremantle, but you know, it does make you say, well, yes, I do wonder, well, why aren't other councils doing this? Why aren't density targets somewhat clearer? So yes, I guess I would like to see a bigger conversation around density and a clearer conversation. I don't think planning has particularly won the hearts and minds of the community when it comes to density, yes, or why we're doing it.
I suppose one of the problems is when you just use the word density without further definition, you can conjure up in Fremantle terms a precinct where there are lots of Johnson courts all around and what people would consider perhaps to be a lower socioeconomic development. Yes. Whereas one gets the impression, if you look at the heart of Beaconsfield plans and so on, that we're looking at something much more sophisticated.
We certainly would be. I mean, although I'm conscious of... I can accept that there will also be housing which is not, you know, it has to be affordable housing as well.
Yes.
You know, one of the traps we can fall into is to push infill. You know, we sort of promise it'll be so perfect, it'll be so. The reality is, I mean, I think Coburn's quite a good example. We're at Coburn Central, where there is, I think, reasonable style of development. It's not an architectural gem. But they are viable apartments that are affordable for people, and people who perhaps couldn't afford to live in Fremantle.
And near transport system.
And near transport system. So, you know, I think planning can fall into a trap of sort of promising that every development will be paid for gold sort of thing. That, you know, yes, obviously, in an environment like Fremantle, of course, we need to be very, very careful about how we do density and getting it right and how we get infill right. And it's very, very difficult to get that right.
Now, Phil, the other thing that you read periodic reports about in online newspapers or the occasional hard copy newspaper or hear people chatting about in the cafes around Fremantle off and on is Fremantle's dying. Mm. There are empty shop fronts and so on and so forth. The Shipping News did an article in its The Pulse feature the other day looking at Ray Avenue, and you can see the established businesses.
Yes.
You can see areas which commercially aren't as attractive. Yes. Pop-up stores come and they go, and people start to grumble, probably mostly about the city centre of Fremantle, where at different times it looks a little that way. Is there an issue? If there is it something that's periodical, that's cyclical, that reflects economies? Is it something that the council, and as I said earlier, you were brought in when the ticket, in a sense, was to revitalise. Are there things that councils can do, and can they do more, to answer the question?
Look.
I mean what's your experience told you over the last 5 years?
I mean, certainly that what's happening in Fremantle is not unique. I mean, there are some very large and powerful commercial and technological forces which are changing things very, very rapidly. I fear COVID has just accelerated that. You know, I always use the example that I live in Subiaco. When I moved to Subiaco 20 years ago, there was 4 CD stores. You know, there's none now. They've just reopened one, a sort of specialist record store. But, you know, but that sort of point, that there's a whole range of things which you used to buy in shops, which you simply don't now. And I don't see that changing. I don't love that particularly, personally, but it is the way the world has gone, you know, very, very rapidly. Online retail, you know, bulk retail is huge. Again, as a planner, you drive to, our industrial areas are full of shops now. You know, your JB Hi-Fi's and those kind of bulk places. I'll just drop a water.
Yes.
So I would say that those what's happening in Fremantle is not unique to Fremantle. And very similar conversations are happening with most kind of historical Main Street environments. I guess it's probably seen as more acute in Fremantle because it's probably the largest, if you like, Main Street style town centre. It probably is, in fact. Yeah. I mean, councils can do things, and we've tried to. So, you know, what are the things we've tried to do? So we've tried to look at removing certain planning controls to try and make changes of use easier, to sort of allow a greater ability to react to what's happening in the market. That is, again, gets challenging in a place like Fremantle, because we also have, it's not just around land use, it's also around the historic shop fronts. And so one of the pressure points we've had is, on one hand, we want to allow for a rapidly changing retail environment, but we also, of course, we have historic buildings that we need to look after, unlike perhaps other places. Obviously there are levers around car parking that is very controversial.
Yes.
And it's a difficult one for the council, because certainly from the retailer's perspective, they will look at places like Garden City and say, you can shop, you can park for free there. You know, that's our competition. We don't quite see it that way, because of course we said, well, this is a different type of centre to Garden City. This is never going to compete with Garden City in that sense, and it's not, nor should it be. It'll never be like that. And of course, in a city centre where there are multiple uses, you can't have free parking. It would be unworkable, because of course the parking needs to be rotated around for all the kinds of uses and activities that occur in a city, rather than just retail. I can't see nothing wrong with that, but it's just a single use activity. It's just a big shop. So the council could never have an environment where it had major ground at grade car parks on the fringe. So there is a lot of conversation about, you know, parking pricing and how that may or may not influence retail.
Yes.
So I think another one which councils could do, and maybe could do a bit more, is around playing to our strengths, which I think are our streets and our streetscapes. So if you look at the West End, if you look at Market Street, you know, they're beautiful streets, even with roads in them. But I do think if we can make our streets better, more attractive places to be, then we will attract people.
So Fremantle becomes a destination based on its historic, and it's cultural.
And it's what we have, which is unique.
Yes.
You know, it is genuinely unique.
Yes.
And there is no town centre like Fremantle in Western Australia. It is genuinely unique. So I think we have to play to what we're good at, which is having great quality streetscapes and places which are not like any other.
Some people remark, just because they keep seeing approvals and little developments popping up here and there, that we've suddenly become a place of bars and pubs and cafes and restaurants. Mm. Is that necessarily a bad thing?
Again, look, I think it's sort of inevitable, I suppose. I don't personally love that. I don't personally love the fact that it feels like the only sort of booming land uses at the moment are kind of like, food and beverage, hospitality land uses. But the difficulty is that's what's being applied for, and what else is going to go there. I don't think we can ever go back to what we had, which was, we're not going to have department stores in Fremantle anyway. It's not, that won't work, or CD stores. So I don't love that. I wish there was some greater diversity, but I accept also that this is where the demand is. And if you want a booming, vibrant city, then you need to allow for these sorts of things. So I think as long as they are done well, and in a sort of, I hope in Fremantle, we can encourage a more unique, less generic sort of brand of that, to, again, to sort of mix out a bit more eclecticism, a bit more diversity.
Yes.
You know, so places like the synagogue is a classic example of that.
Yes.
So, you know, I would love to see other things. I would love to see more shops, but I'm also realistic enough to know that, commercially those aren't what people want to do. And there has to be a commercial outcome as well.
Phil, if you were the emperor, we'll give you two or three or four or 5 years around Fremantle, are there any particular things that you would love to see attempted to be done, something that you think the Fremantle ought to be aspiring to? There's a lot of discussion about what brand Fremantle has. Occasionally it's marketed.
Yep.
But are there particular changes or things that you could imagine Fremantle? Are there institutions that Fremantle ought to get here? We've got the Maritime Museum. There's talk about the film industry starting to get a foothold. Are there things that you've thought about?
Yeah, look, I've already talked about Fremantle playing to its strengths. So I think that's the...
Yes.
That's
an important concept.
It does need to play to its strengths. I think we need to... we must have more residents. Ultimately, as a planner, I've always had an assumption around land use and residential land use, and ultimately the residential land use being my first presumption is resident is can we use this land for housing? Obviously sometimes it's patently unsuitable, but I always start that housing is always a thing that's worth having, and that feels even more important now of all the challenges happening to retail. The one thing that will never be put online or, you know, is people will always need a place to live. And when people are living in a place, and if that place has attractive and comfortable streets and public spaces, people will use those.
So I primary think. Proposition so, is bring people so in. That's been reflected in different parts of central Fremantle with apartment development and also moving out into the suburbs.
And I think we need more of it. I think we need, so I would be, if I could had a magic wand, I would certainly put a lot more residents into central Fremantle. I would also then, I suppose the next big thing, where I would look to our waterfront, which feels like our forgotten asset.
Well, we once had a marine industry, and I'm not sure how significant it is now. There are parts of Mews Road that look very empty, for example.
Yes. Yeah, there are. And I mean, we would certainly hope, and I would love to see. I don't know how realistic it is. I think the marine industry is, again, it's part of Fremantle's unique character, part of its kind of flavour. One of the things that makes, I think, Fremantle such a special place is, you know, there is this sense of authenticity. There's this, you know, it's often spoken about, you see the ships passing as you walk down, you know, Henry Street in the West End. You can see the ships passing. We do have that authenticity, and of course, that's our maritime heritage, and the marine industry is part of that. And as much as that, if that can be retained, of course, I do, again, I'm realistic enough to see that perhaps these things won't have a long-term future in a town like Fremantle, quite simply because technology changes and the world changes.
Well, a container port's possible move south to Kenina is an example of that.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, where has a container port remained in a historic town centre in the world? Probably nowhere that I'm aware of. They tend to move out for obvious reasons. So, you know, I guess there is an inevitability about that. I think it presents a challenge and a huge opportunity for Fremantle, but one that Fremantle has to embrace, I mean, ultimately, because you look at Victoria Quay, you look at North Quay, and it would be an urban renewal opportunity unprecedented almost in the country. I mean, it would be incredible.
Let me turn the conversation, the same conversation really, but to the other side of it. What are the negatives about Fremantle at the moment as you perceive it? And not meaning to limit or necessarily introduce the conversation, but people often talk about if they're out of town is coming to Fremantle, they feel a certain anti-social element in different parts of Fremantle. And the answer to that might simply be, well, this is just a particular aspect of Fremantle. This is part of Fremantle, and Fremantle people are used to that and are not discouraged by it. But what are the negatives? What are the things that ought to be confronted and dealt with?
certainly, you know, there are perceptions, and you know, of a lack of safety. You know, I've certainly heard that. You know, it would be crazy not to. And certainly, as one who's been, you know, working in Fremantle for a number of years now, many late night meetings, it doesn't always feel like the safest place to walk through late at night. You know, and again, I mean, it's a very complicated. Very, very complicated problem. There's no simple answer to that. And of course, the strengths of a place are also its weaknesses. So of course, we love Fremantle for its kind of grit and diversity, and its, you know, the fact that it's a real city, the fact it's an authentic place, the fact that we provide community facilities here. But of course, another side of that, of course, is that there are then some problems around antisocial behaviour and homelessness and crime. Now, as city, you know, I guess those problems are not, of course, again, not unique to Fremantle.
No, you'll find them in any place.
In any city, I think there is a tendency in Fremantle to kind of look inward a bit, and to say this is a Fremantle problem. It's a problem throughout the Western world, and perhaps beyond that. You know, that there are city centres can be slightly scary places. I think within the council's, accepting it's a kind of complex question, within the council's grasp, there obviously, I think, are things around, again, trying to get housing and people back into the city. I think what the best insurance against that, again, is having as much activity in the city as you can.
Turning to another topic that's sort of a perennial, in my experience, relates to the financial health of the city, and a lot of that conversation has, in more recent times, been around the King Square redevelopment. Yes. Again, looking at Fremantle and comparing it to other places, is Fremantle unique? I suppose it's part of the revitalisation, it's part of the council trying to, in a sense, force change, and perhaps some other local government areas, even big ones, don't have the same sort of city centre. But is there a challenge financing a local government at all these days?
Yeah, look, it's a huge challenge. Fremantle has, has particular challenges. They're challenges which the council can manage, and all councils have different ones. But for example, if you look at Fremantle, obviously we have a stock of heritage buildings, for example, which I don't think any other council has. So obviously we have the Roundhouse. We're starting at the Roundhouse, starting at the Arts Centre. So Town Hall. Okay, most councils have a Town Hall. So we have that obligation. That's one, of course, the council takes very seriously. We run an Arts Centre. Okay, that's partly funded by government, but also significantly funded by us. Again, a regional facility, something we're very proud of, but again, not something that every other council does. We still fund a cat bus. Again, something that no other council does. So there are a number of areas which the council has additional, I wouldn't say obligations, because they're things this the council chooses to do. The council doesn't have to do them. The council doesn't have to run an art centre. It doesn't have to support the community legal centre. Again, we fund that. Again, partly, mostly by government, but we partly fund that. We have a visitor centre. So there are a whole range of services this council offers which other councils don't. So of course, you know, that creates pressures on the council's finances. And of course, King Square is a once in a, more than a generational, you know, it would be a one in a 100-year investment in a building like that. So, but ultimately, the council is transparent about its finances. The council can manage its services. The council streets get swept, the building licenses get issued, and the council performs its functions. And having said that, of course, there's never enough to do all the things that are demanded. But that, again, that would be the same. That would be no different to any other council. But of course, we could always like more. And in an environment where I think the one thing that I think is really important, and perhaps where I would like to have done more as CEO, is to be more transparent about the finances. As a non-accountant, as a planner, I wanted to come in and say, I think if we're really clear of the community around this is how much you pay on rates and this is where this money goes, one of the frustrating things is that when you deal with a council and make decisions around a budget is that in the main, people will only see the part that they're interested in. So I get around budget time, lots of people complaining, saying, why have you not funded my project? And of course I say, well, it's not that I don't think it's a good idea, it's just I've got 15 things which are a good idea. And that's the problem for the council, you know. And I've tried to, and I don't think I've been quite successful in this, have a system that actually is very transparent about that. So the community can at least see, if we fund one more thing, we must defund something else. Well, yeah, it doesn't obviously grow. There is a finite amount of resources. And so, you know, to try and manage that in a way where people can kind of see that.
But when you say you might have done more, I don't understand you'd be saying things have been hidden, but you're saying, when you use the word transparency, as I'd understand it, it ought to be possible to communicate better with the ratepayers about how the finances
yes,
work.
Yes, yes.
Are there any sort of easy or obvious ways to do that? Does it require some different reporting system?
I think it probably does. I mean, look, I don't want to be disloyal to accountants, but I think it's sort of in the realm of accountants, and we sort of... We have accountants who run the system, and we get an audit, and the audit says, yes, this you know, council's lawfully performing its functions, and you know. And yeah, I'm like, for me, it would be if we could present it in a non-financial way. It's a bit like the planning conversation. I don't think planners have particularly, so I'm not just down on accountants. I think planners haven't really expressed why we do planning very clearly, and I would say the same around accountants. You know, if you looked at the council said, yeah, okay, it's a big bucket of resources, and it must be possible, I would have thought, to then start saying, okay, well, if for every $100 of the council, you know, 25 cents goes here and 50 cents goes there, and if you want to put more in this, then you have to take some out of something else, or bring more money into the system somehow. So, yeah, I would, in my mind, I can we're transparent, but it's going beyond transparency. It's around
it's communication,
yes.
Yeah. Phil, we start to draw this conversation a little bit longer than some of those I have, but important, because your era has been an important one at the council, if I may say so. When you sit quietly thinking about the last 5 years, what are the things that you... whether they're obvious to many of us or not, that you're particularly proud about, pleased about, that you've achieved?
Look, I'm very, very pleased about the team we've built at the council. So in terms of the staff, we have an exceptional team at the council, and I'm very, very proud of that, and very sad to leave that team. They're very good people. They care about the community. They care about their jobs, and they're very good at what they do. And one of the most gratifying things for me has been, and again, my approach has always been one to try and have things done at the best level they can be, usually the lowest level they can be. And so we've empowered managers to get out of their way. So I've employed the best people I could, and then sort of got out of their way. As much as you can in an environment, of course, where you need to have consistency and manage risk, but within that context, and so those things are in conflict. But so that's been really, really gratifying. I talked previously about the relationship with the council and staff has been exceptional. I do think that we have a unique relationship with council and staff, I've worked at that, and the council have, and I take some joy in that.
Is that the secret to it? There are not infrequent inquiries or near inquiries and controversies about a range of local governments. Here in the metropolitan area, is it what's required to, if there is a sort of a magic treatment here, to make that relationship between elected members and staff a harmonious and productive one?
Look, I think you need a good governance framework. You need a good, clear governance framework, and you need staff who understand how to apply that and can apply that. You need a council that respects that, and yeah, I guess it's respect for each other's positions. I do understand the kind of pressures the councils are under.
When you say that, are you meaning that, using political with a small p, that there are demands on councillors to produce certain outcomes?
Yeah, or to make certain decisions, or to be accountable for every single aspect of council's performance. So, you know, I mean, if, for example, there has been a failure of in customer service, and the mayor's asked about that. The mayor, it's not okay for the mayor to, in the media, say that's a staff matter. That would be saying mayor cops out. A councillor once said to me, I was accused of hiding behind the law, and I said, hiding behind the law? Aren't you supposed to follow the law? You know, that's okay. Like, following law is a good thing, right? You know, and in fact, you know, I'd rather be accused of hiding behind. So, but it's just this kind of spin that gets put on it. You know, yeah, the hiding behind the law. I mean, that's the expression the council used to me. It's like, well, what does that mean? What would be wrong with following the law? That's what you're supposed to do. So, I lost my train of thought a bit, Michael, but I think we need to kind of respect each other. What I've tried to do where the council, you know, I've tried to not put them in a position they feel they can't defend. And I've tried to inform them around why we've made operational decisions. I've tried to enable them to be able to, I guess the word is defend operational decisions, because often decisions are made which don't please certain sections of the community. And so, course, that and people go to the council and expect the council to be able to kind of fix it.
Yes,
you know, it's again, it's a bit like with the planning. You know, we can, I mean, the councillors, you can say, oh, you like to a councillor where you're there to administer the local planning scheme, state planning policies, but a street for angry residents will be saying, I voted you in to represent me. I don't want to hear about, you know, a quasi judicial system where you're supposed to, you know, have regard to that, you know, and straight away you've lost the local community on that one. The community will say, you were voted in to represent me. Indeed, the Act actually says a councillor's role is to represent the community.
Yes.
So it's not very helpful when you know, and this is one of the things I think is really interesting, is the mismatch between local government and planning legislation. The local government legislation clearly says a councillor's role is to represent the community. And yet,
There are restrictions or strictures.
But of course there are, you know, and so you know, things get very much dumbed down. So I've always tried to have sympathy for a councillor who feels under pressure not to be able to give the community the answer they want. You know, a fully compliant development, the community may still not like it.
Yes. And what else is on your list that you take away and quietly put with the other successes?
I'm very proud of the King Square project, you know, to have brought that to implementation, you know, where has been great. That, you know, I think we've employed the right people to do it. The project has been well managed. The project is within the original business plan estimates, albeit allowing for some inflationary escalation, but beyond that, that's been well managed. And I'm delighted to see that. I do think it is a project that will at least have a catalytic impact on revitalisation. You know, I'm not naive about the challenges that cities face now. I fear that COVID has perhaps accelerated some of that, you know, but I do think it was the right thing to do. I mean, if you go back to the base principles, the council needed a new office. That had to happen anyway. The investment that Serona made was never going to be made unless there was a good quality building adjoining it. And so that was all part of the agreement. So a lot of people at the time said, well, once Serona had done their building, so why do we need to do this? Well, that was always part of the agreement. So the council investment has unlocked unprecedented private sector development. Now, of course, sections of the community who would prefer Three Mile never, ever change, of course, still disagree with that. But I think the consensus is, we did need to revitalise, and this is one of the things we need to do that.
Well, Phil, we get to the end of the conversation. We'll look forward to seeing what Phil St. John does in the time ahead. One final question, which I think the answer is implicit in everything you've said. You've been in local government a long time. You've been the CEO of an important local government in Western Australia for the last 5 years. Does local government remain an important player in the domestic, social, community life of West Australians? The answer is perhaps obvious, but is it a diminishing role, or is it as important as ever?
Look, I think it is as important as ever. I have a great admiration for the system and for councillors, notwithstanding its failings.
it is the area of government, obviously, I mean, it's obvious it's closest to the people, it's easily the most transparent. It is one where you are can be much closer to decision making, much closer to the people. Of course, you know, that creates its challenges. You know, I remember, I mean, I started my career in state government, and when I moved to local government, not having to go to the state, but how different it was in terms of transparency. And I think it's how it has to be. So look, I think local government has great strengths, you know, and there's a great strength in the system. And you do see, I mean, obviously the failings of local government are, you know, are well publicised when they happen. But of course, for every council that fails, there's 20 that operate effectively under great pressure, you know, with great difficult, but dealing with very difficult, complex questions. You know, I mean, like the question, how do you reconcile, turning a city around? How do you change a city? How do you get infill into historic areas? Are not simple things, and of course there'll be diverse views on those. And I think in the main, councils deal with those pretty well. You know, and yes, from time to time the system doesn't work, but for everyone that doesn't, there's plenty that work very well, and they just don't get written up in the media. But you can go and sit in any council chamber, and you'll see people, councillors. I mean, in the main, I think very hardworking. You know, they are genuinely dedicated to trying to make the community better and be responsive. And I've seen far more good, committed councillors than I've seen, yes, you know, poor ones, shall we say, you know, in my career, far, far more. You know, they're very committed people and who care about their community. So yes, I absolutely see a role for local government, and I hope it strengthens.
Well, Phil, there's no doubt that local government works not only because of the elected councillors, but because of the dedicated council officers who support them, and to whom you already paid an appropriate tribute earlier, but they include you. So thank you very much. If I can be bold enough to do it on behalf of Fremantle people, for being the CEO for the last 5 years, and good luck with everything you do.
Thank you, Mark.